So imagine you're living under this massive, completely translucent dome, like a giant glass shell over your whole neighborhood.
Right, like something out of a sci-fi movie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But here's the catch. Your apartment, it barely has a kitchen.
Yeah, that's the part that really gets people.
I mean, there's no massive center island. There's no giant double-door fridge humming in the corner, and definitely no walk-in pantry to just, hoard a month's worth of groceries.
No, not at all.
But in exchange for giving up all that private space, your entire neighborhood essentially becomes your personal dining room and, like, your extended pantry.
Which is a huge mental shift for most of us.
Totally. Welcome to today's deep dive, everyone. If you're someone who just loves to learn and, you're always chasing that next big aha moment, you are in the exact right place. Because today, we are pulling apart this totally fascinating stack of source material.
We've got concept plates, architectural renders, highly detailed planning notes.
Yeah, and it's all detailing this radical blueprint called the urban sphere. We're going to explore this prototype for what the designers are calling radial district living.
And the core mission of these sources is to test a really specific, honestly ambitious hypothesis.
Right. Which is what? Exactly.
Well, it's this idea that if we fundamentally change the physical three-dimensional geometry of a neighborhood, does it inevitably rewrite the daily economic and social lives of the people living inside it?
So, like physical form actually dictating social function.
Exactly. The planners are arguing that you can't change how people live without first totally changing the literal shape of where they live.
Okay, let's unpack this because whenever we look at standard city planning, there's always this expectation of just rigid
Oh,
predictability.
yeah, the classic grid.
Right? You look at a map of almost any modern American city, and you're just looking at a flat chessboard,
Yeah.
perfectly straight intersecting lines. It's a grid system where all the properties are defined by square edges and neatly categorized into these distinct separate zones.
But the urban sphere concept just completely wipes that traditional city block grid right out of our minds.
It really does. The spatial landscape here begins with a spherical envelope. So instead of laying out a flat square grid and just dropping boxy buildings onto it, the entire footprint is organized radially.
And the aerial context plates in the notes illustrate this beautifully.
Yeah, the visual of it is wild.
Right. From above, the district is capped by this giant translucent shell. And then wrapping around the very outside perimeter is this continuous circulation ring road.
Like a boundary line.
Exactly. And from that outer ring, you have arterial access points and these green wedges that cut directly inward right toward the center.
And crowning the very top of the dome is this massive open hole.
Yes, designated in the schematics as the central aperture.
The easiest way I could visualize this geometry was to picture a bicycle wheel or, maybe a perfectly sliced pie.
A sliced pie is a great analogy.
Right, because the landscape, the parks, the circulation paths, they act like the spokes. They start at that outer perimeter ring and they funnel you inward toward the really high density center.
Which is the absolute opposite of the repetitive parallel grid.
Yeah, where you just drive block after block in endless straight lines.
Yeah.
And the designers seem highly conscious of the psychological impact of this geometry, right?
Oh, completely. The text actually devotes an entire section to an urban form lesson.
I saw that. They draw a really stark contrast between two concepts.
Right, what they term exterior legibility versus the interior experience.
So reading through those concept plates, I interpreted exterior legibility to mean that, like, from the outside, the sphere acts as this very clear, hyper-organized mathematical object.
Yeah, very clean.
You see the smooth dome, the perfect radial wedges, the exact circular perimeter. It genuinely looks like a pristine spaceship just gently landed in the landscape.
It does, but the planners specifically note that living inside a pristine mathematical object would be psychological torture.
Oh, totally. We'd feel like living inside a cold piece of Tupperware.
Exactly. And that's a really critical vulnerability of utopian architecture. The source text actively attempts to solve for it.
How so?
Well, the interior experience has to intentionally shatter that exterior rigidity. If the outside is sterile and legible, the inside must be messy, organic, and complex.
So it needs to feel human.
Precisely. From within, that highly organized spherical field breaks down into meandering internal streets, asymmetrical mid-rise housing blocks.
Scattered tall white towers, irregular tree rows.
Right, and complex cast shadows. It's
Yeah.
meant to feel grounded.
The street level renders really capture that intended messiness. You see pedestrians navigating these winding paths, filtered light dappling through the canopy, and civic corridors that don't feel clinical at all.
It's aiming for true human-scale urbanism.
Because the dome is really just an environmental envelope, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the actual fabric where people walk and live is designed to feel like a vibrant, dense, naturally evolved city street.
Yes. And by establishing that specific physical layout, the radial paths pulling everyone to the center, the dense clustering, the physical boundary of the shell overhead, they naturally constrain outward sprawl.
And when you restrict outward expansion, interior real estate suddenly becomes hyper-premium.
Which forces a radical change in what happens inside the actual apartments.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because this brings us back to the kitchen.
The famous small kitchen housing model.
Right. Because space is at such an absolute premium, the source material says that the vast majority of residential units under this dome are equipped with incredibly compact, everyday kitchens.
We are talking bare minimums.
Yeah, like absolute survival mode kitchens.
Yeah.
A sink, a two-burner induction hob, a tiny under-counter fridge, minimal storage, and maybe just enough prep space for reheating or assembling a very simple meal.
And we are so conditioned to view the size of our kitchen as a proxy for our ability to feed ourselves well.
Oh, 100%. The immediate reaction to a tiny kitchen is pure anxiety. I mean, wait, are you taking away my full suburban kitchen? For a lot of people, that sounds like a massive downgrade.
It really does sound like you're giving up your independence.
Exactly. In a typical modern suburb, you might have 10,000 people who each own a 300-square-foot kitchen, outfitted with commercial-grade appliances.
Appliances that sit completely unused for 23 hours a day.
Right. It is a massive, decentralized duplication of resources. But without it, the fear is this forced reliance on eating expensive, unhealthy takeout every single night.
What's fascinating here is how the text addresses this exact anxiety. They explain the mechanics of what they call the neighborhood pantry.
The neighborhood pantry. I love that term.
Clever, right?
Yeah.
The design doesn't actually remove food choice. It shifts the physical capacity for food storage and preparation from the private, isolated apartment into a shared neighborhood-wide infrastructure.
And the mechanism behind that shift relies on a very specific economic flywheel, doesn't it?
It does. Because you only have a tiny fridge, you physically cannot hoard groceries for a month.
You literally don't have the space for a Costco run.
Right. You are forced to buy just what you need for the next 24 to 48 hours.
So the spatial constraint of the apartment naturally generates this steady, highly reliable daily demand for prepared meals, cafes, and small fresh purchases.
Exactly. And the downstream effect of that guaranteed daily demand is that local restaurants and vendors absolutely thrive.
Because they have a predictable customer base walking past their doors every single day.
Yes. And because those local businesses are thriving, they have the capital to buy in bulk from high-quality local grocers, bakers, butchers, specialty importers, commissary suppliers.
So the restaurants effectively fund the creation of a massive, highly efficient local supply chain.
And here is the genius part of the system for the resident.
Yeah, this part blew my mind.
You get to piggyback on that commercial supply chain. You aren't relying on the sad, wilted vegetables that survived the logistical journey to a standard spread-out supermarket.
Because the local restaurants demand high-quality, diverse ingredients to stay competitive, those specialty importers and artisanal butchers set up shop right inside the district.
Right. A standard, low-density residential neighborhood could never sustainably support a hyper-specialized artisanal cheese shop or a daily fresh fish market.
There just isn't enough concentrated daily foot traffic.
Exactly. But in the urban sphere, because those vendors are primarily anchored by the bulk orders from the thriving local restaurants, they can afford to keep their doors open to the public.
So the resident can just walk downstairs and buy an incredibly fresh piece of fish or a really specialized ingredient that the restaurants themselves are using.
The spatial limitation of your apartment creates the financial density required to elevate the standard of living for everyone.
It's a trade-off. You give up private square footage, and in return, you gain access to significantly better ingredients and way more variety than you ever could before.
The flywheel is elegant in theory, but as the sources explicitly detail, a shared, vibrant food infrastructure requires a meticulously balanced economic engine to actually survive.
Yeah, it can't just be a theoretical utopia.
Right. This model instantly collapses if the urban sphere functions as a sleepy bedroom community where everyone leaves for work at 9 in the morning and the whole dome is a ghost town until 6 in the evening.
To prevent that collapse, the planners rely on something called vertical zoning.
Which is key to this whole concept.
Yeah, and to understand why this matters, mm-hmm. you have to think about the horizontal zoning of a typical suburb.
Right, where everything is spread out.
Exactly. You have a massive tract of land dedicated only to houses. When you want to buy coffee or go to the dentist, you have to get in your car and drive 15 minutes across town to a totally separate commercial zone.
But the urban sphere compresses all of that horizontally spread out activity into vertical layers.
The text actually defines the prototype not as a housing project with leftover retail at grade, but explicitly as a restaurant and services district with housing above.
That distinction is everything. The ground floors are entirely dedicated to active, daily uses that require foot traffic.
So bakeries, cafes, clinics, daycares,
salons, repair shops, fitness centers, galleries, all of that is on the ground.
And then as you move up,
the lower and mid-level floors transition into professional offices, co-working spaces, studios, and live work units.
And then finally, the upper floors, reaching into those tall white towers we mentioned, they hold the bulk of the actual residential housing.
But as you pointed out, the math has to pencil out.
Yeah, if everyone living in those upper floors just commutes to a different city for work every day, those ground floor cafes and bakeries are still going to go bankrupt by 2 p.m.
Exactly. So the planners actually ran the statistical breakdown on a target population of 15,000 residents.
Okay, 15,000 people under the dome.
Right. And to keep the layered economy buzzing, the critical design metric is a 30% local work target.
Meaning 30% of the employed residents must work inside the sphere itself.
Yes. They work from home, they work in the mid-level co-working spaces, or they staff the ground floor service and professional economy.
So 30% of 15,000 residents, that gives us roughly 4,500 internally supported workers.
Leaving 10,500 people who commute out of the district for work.
On paper, losing 2/3 of your population during the day sounds kind of detrimental.
It does. But urban planners know that 4,500 people actively moving around, taking lunch breaks, having coffee meetings, running errands, that is actually a massive baseline of activity.
It's the minimum viable threshold required to make this a real daytime neighborhood.
Exactly. It keeps it economically solvent.
But sustaining that level of commercial activity introduces immense logistical hurdles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You are essentially building the logistical spine of a massive cruise ship, but stretching it out across a neighborhood.
Oh, the physical infrastructure required to support the neighborhood pantry flywheel is largely invisible, but incredibly robust.
Like?
Well, the concept plates detail these complex alleyway systems designed to handle frequent, massive deliveries without disrupting the pedestrian flow at all.
Right, because you can't have delivery trucks plowing through a quiet cafe patio.
Exactly. The sources outline shared back-end infrastructure as well. Mm-hmm. Multiple vendors utilize massive centralized cold storage facilities.
And shared prep kitchens.
Yes. Shared prep kitchens to maximize their limited footprints. And there are also robust district-wide waste and compost loops designed specifically to handle the massive output of a concentrated restaurant district.
It's a highly engineered machine designed to prove this one central philosophy stated in the text.
Density funds local culture, and local culture makes density livable.
That quote is so good. If you pack 15,000 people into a radial grid under a dome, you generate the financial density to actually support amazing bakeries, specialized clinics, and vibrant event spaces.
And having all of those cultural amenities immediately accessible is what makes the compromise of a minimalist apartment acceptable.
Even desirable for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
So we have this beautifully integrated theory of economics and spatial geometry. But the sources do not shy away from the ultimate reality check here.
No, they don't. The physics.
Yeah, the physics of actually constructing a giant translucent dome over 15,000 people. The planning notes classify the updated renders as plausible as a concept image.
Which is architect speak for proceed with caution.
Right. They attach a severe warning that the visual shell should not be interpreted as fully engineered architecture.
This raises an important question, which is the primary crossroads for the project's feasibility. It all comes down to the nature of the dome itself.
Okay, what do you mean?
Is it a true structural enclosure, like a massive load-bearing building that just happens to contain a neighborhood? Or is it a lighter environmental canopy that just sits independently over towers that are structurally autonomous and up to local building codes?
Because if you attempt to build it as a single structural enclosure, the engineering of the shell span and the support systems becomes exponentially more complex.
Exponentially, particularly when you factor in seismic activity.
Oh, earthquakes. I hadn't even thought of that.
The physics of seismic movement present a massive hurdle here. In an earthquake, tall internal towers are engineered to sway and flex,
right,
to absorb the kinetic energy.
Yeah.
But a massive, rigid dome behaves entirely differently. It resists movement.
So if the swaying towers are structurally connected to the rigid dome,
the different harmonic frequencies would literally tear the connection points apart.
Wow. Okay.
Therefore, the canopy likely has to be structurally independent, which adds massive complexity to the foundational engineering of the perimeter ring.
The text actually lists a whole gauntlet of these civil plausibility hurdles. Beyond earthquakes, there's the sheer volume of stormwater runoff.
That's a big one.
I mean, the surface area of a dome covering 15,000 people is immense. During a torrential downpour, millions of gallons of water will shed off the glass and slide down toward that perimeter ring road.
You are essentially engineering a localized dam spillway in the middle of a city.
Just to prevent the lower levels from catastrophically flooding.
Furthermore, the environmental factors of the shell itself require rigorous testing. Like, how do you mitigate massive heat gain from the sun?
It's a giant greenhouse.
Exactly. And how do you manage blinding glare reflecting off acres of translucent panels?
Not to mention the maintenance. The maintenance alone is staggering. The logistics of cleaning miles of glass or, you know, replacing a shattered panel hundreds of feet in the air.
The infrastructure for that doesn't fully exist yet.
Which brings us to the hole at the very top. The central aperture.
Yes.
Looking at the concept plates initially, I just assumed it was purely aesthetic, you know, like a giant skylight to make the dome feel less claustrophobic.
Many people assume that, but the thermodynamics of the design dictate that it is highly functional and critical for life safety.
Critical for life safety.
Yes. In the event of a major fire, a sealed dome would instantly trap smoke. It would act like an oven and become lethal within minutes.
Oh, right. Because the smoke has nowhere to go.
Exactly. So the central aperture actually functions as a massive exhaust system. It leverages what's called the stack effect.
Ah, it's the exact same physics as the flue in a standard fireplace.
Precisely. As hot air naturally rises toward the aperture, it creates negative pressure at the ground level.
Which pulls fresh, cool air in through the perimeter access point.
You got it. The central aperture provides continuous natural ventilation for the entire district.
So it's essentially a giant chimney.
A giant life-saving chimney. And it also serves as a critical access point for heavy maintenance equipment.
Oh, that makes sense.
And crucially, it allows direct natural daylight to penetrate deep into the center of the sphere, ensuring those dense interior streets receive actual sunlight.
It is genuinely fascinating to watch this romantic, utopian vision of a perfectly enclosed city just immediately slam into the brutal realities of fluid dynamics, fire codes, and structural engineering.
It really is. But to their credit, the sources frame these hurdles not as deal breakers, but as the necessary friction of prototyping.
Right. You establish the radical vision, the radial geometry, the neighborhood pantry, the hyper-localized economy, and then you just ruthlessly test it against physics.
Exactly. The urban sphere is not a frivolous sci-fi render designed merely to look compelling in an architectural portfolio.
No, it's a meticulously thought out blueprint.
It really is. It demonstrates how altering the physical envelope of a neighborhood can totally reorganize our food supply, our local economy, and our daily human interactions.
It forces us to rigorously question what we actually need to own privately and what is vastly more efficient when shared communally.
Which brings us to the biggest takeaway. The entire design relies on decentralizing the traditional concept of the home.
By moving your cooking, your working, and your socializing out of your private four-walled unit and into the shared radial district.
Right. It completely challenges our fundamental definition of property.
So what does this all mean for us today?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the downstream implication of that shift is profound. If the neighborhood pantry and the vertical economy function as designed, the future of real estate might look very different.
Really different.
The value proposition shifts entirely away from buying maximum private square footage with a massive, isolated kitchen.
Instead, you are effectively buying a subscription to a completely integrated neighborhood-wide ecosystem.
Exactly. The line between owning property and accessing a highly tuned urban system begins to blur.
Are you buying empty space? Or are you buying access to the flywheel?
That is the ultimate question.
It's an incredible concept to mull over. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the sources, everyone.
It's been a fun one.
It really has. The next time you are out walking, take a hard look at the layout of your own neighborhood grid.
Look at the isolated intersections, the separated commercial zones.
Yeah, and think about all those empty private kitchens. And just for a moment, imagine how differently it all might operate if you wiped away those rigid lines, reorganized everything into a circle, and dropped a massive translucent canopy over the entire ecosystem. Until next time.